Chapter 1. Day 1. The day was overcast and chill, heavy clouds scudding impatiently across a pewter sky as spots of rain started spattering the windows. 6 a.m. and the central heating had just clicked on. The flat wouldn't be warm for at least another half hour. A sprinkling of goosebumps showed on her naked arms and legs, and she shivered with cold. The black shorty nightie quite inadequate to the task of covering, let alone warming, her 6 feet frame. She heard, rather than felt, the plop and splash of blood as it hit the marble-tiled floor in the bathroom. Then she felt it too, a wetness between the thighs, a drawing pain in her belly, and a heaviness from the waist down that made her limbs feel like buckling. The blood smelled metallic, and as she watched, transfixed, more of it ran down the insides of her legs, spreading in a pool at her feet.
"Mad,"
she whispered softly.
"Mad, mad, mad!"
Propping her head against her fingertips, she watched helplessly as the life she was carrying, the life she'd so longed for, slipped away from her.
"I'm losing this baby,"
she whispered under her breath.
"My baby. Dove's baby."
Then she thought of her father, with skin the texture of jet, the tall and distinguished Matthew Pierre. This retired architect, originally from the island of Trinidad, now living close by in Queen's Park, was suffering from the advanced stages of Parkinson's disease. A normally taciturn man, Matthew had not been able to stop talking about the prospect of his grandfathering the child of his only daughter, Tamsin, where he'd been convinced that at 37 she left it too late and it would never happen. So sad, he said, that Tamsin's mother, her maman, the irrepressible daughter of a French-Jewish baking family who died of breast cancer 10 years earlier, could not be alive to see her own daughter become a mother. Her ribs still ached dully from the kicking she'd received in an assault some months previously by a man, apparently called Bear. And the side of her head still throbbed whenever she was stressed, as she was now, from the blade that had all but ripped open the edge of her skull during the attack. The tight curls had grown back where the hospital had shaved her to administer the railway tracks of black sutures, and she let her hair grow longer than the short cap of frizz she usually sported to further mask the scarring. Andy, her hairdresser at Curligig in Westbourne Grove, had worked wonders, and some of her old confidence was returning. It was now more than ever she felt the loss of her long-term partner. She ached when she thought about little Ginny and how she'd gone without warning, leaving only a farewell note and a CD of music they both loved. Ginny had guessed about her sometime Israeli lover and martial arts coach Dove as Tammy'd started to show. And that, together with the cocaine habit she'd frequently warned Tammy about, had decided to end the relationship. Lifting the lid of the toilet, Tammy sat down on the seat, leaning forward, her head in her hands, and waited while the last of the blood carrying the baby she'd yearned for so fiercely escaped from her body like sand flooding through an hourglass. Then she stood over the toilet bowl and flushed it several times until the last traces of crimson in the promise it held were gone. She tried to cry. She wanted to cry. Her temples ached and her throat felt tight, but no tears came. It was as though the baby had abandoned her. She was inadequate to the task of bearing a child. Lacking as a woman and with no one in her life to turn for comfort, heaven knows how she'd break the news to her father. Papa would be devastated. It would have to wait until later. Or maybe tomorrow. She stood under the shower for fully 15 minutes as though she could simply wash away the memory and thoughts of what might have been. There was still some seeping residue of blood, so she used some of the standby sanitary ware she kept in the event a heavy period made the usual tampons insufficient in any given month. Then she wandered into the kitchen in her dressing gown and prepared a pot of strong coffee before forcing herself to consider the day ahead. Life goes on, she thought sadly, with a feeling of the irony of it all. Of course, she knew it was her own fault. Her GP, Dr. Aziz, had told her specifically not to engage in any undue physical effort. Her high testosterone levels meant it was mere chance that she conceived at all. Still less likely she would again if this pregnancy didn't go full term. But she obstinately ignored him, continuing to work out in the local Queen's Park gym and at home whenever the time allowed. Then there'd been that scuffle a couple of days ago when a visiting client from the States to whom she was giving close personal protection had been approached, unannounced, in a side street at the back of Grosvenor Hotel, Park Lane, where she was staying, by a member of the press and jostled. The reporter was an overweight individual with a ruddy face and bulbous drinker's nose. The man had stuck a mobile phone microphone under the nose of the thoroughly alarmed client, a young, newly famous pop singer dressed in a black miniskirt and black patent leather thigh-length boots and demanding an interview. Tammy discreetly turned out in a charcoal-gray two-piece trouser suit, turned to the man and softly told him to get lost.
"Come on, love,"
pleaded the reporter, clearly the worse for drink, and ignoring Tammy, addressed the young girl.
"Just a story, darling. Is it true you're after Prince Harry? If it was, you'd be too late now, darling."
Then, apparently noticing Tammy for the first time as she loomed over him.
"And who were you, mister, when you were at home?"
A pause while he examined Tammy with slow deliberation. Then,
"Blimey,"
he intoned, shocked as he got closer and looked up at her.
"It's a bleeding bird. And a good-looking one and all. Always did like the black ones."
And so saying, he dropped the phone where it clattered to the pavement and made a grab for Tammy's breasts. The young charge looked as though she was about to make a run for it. But turning to her, Tammy said,
"Don't worry, this is all perfectly in hand."
Then quietly to the reporter as she strained her rumpled jacket and blouse,
"Now you really don't want to do that, do you, sir?"
"Oh, I think I do, dearie. You blackbirds are like a bit of who's your father, don't you?"
"Well, sir, this blackbird doesn't. Most certainly not in public, and very definitely not with a drunken oaf like you. Now why don't you try to behave like a big boy and get out of our way?"
"Who you calling a big boy, you patronizing black bitch? You come to this country—"
"Do we steal all your women, sir?"
"What? Steal all that? But you're a bleeding—"
A small group of Japanese tourists had begun to gather, and Tammy realized the situation needed to be brought to a speedy conclusion. Turning to look over her shoulder at her now terrified charge, Tammy whispered hastily,
"Hotel, back entrance, you move. I'll deal with this and catch you up. Go on, my dear."
The man staggered slightly and lurched in Tammy's direction, alcohol in his breath, a hand outstretched as he reached again for her breasts. Acknowledging the tourist with a broad smile and a shrug that said, "Whatever do we do in this sort of situation?" Tammy grabbed the man by the outstretched wrist and swiftly spun him around, twisting his arm up his back. He grunted in pain, and Tammy whispered in his ear,
"Let's not make this any more embarrassing than it need be, sir?"
And holding the man fast, she hailed a passing taxi with her free hand. As the cab pulled up, the reporter staggered again, and Tammy caught him under the arms before he could fall. Then, opening the taxi door, she heaved the man in and slammed it behind him.
"Take him anywhere, cabbie, as long as it's away from here,"
she said, grabbing a £20 note from a pocket and thrusting at the driver.
"Okay, darling, you're on,"
the young driver said with a cheery grin, and the taxi sped off. The tourists, gabbling animatedly, began to melt away, and Tammy, acknowledging a worrying twinge in her lower abdomen, followed by a needle point of insistent pain, thought about the words of Dr. Aziz. A gray cloud of uncertainty settled around her. "I'll be fine," she told herself. "I'll be fine." But she wasn't. She pressed her luck that day, and now she paid the price. 7 a.m., time for work. She sighed as her mobile rang.
"Miss Pierre, I think you should come in right away. We've had the most unpleasant email arrive."
Mrs. Gilchrist sounded uncharacteristically perturbed.
"Thank you, Mrs. Gilchrist. I'll check it out on my mobile and be in about 25 minutes.
A pinprick at the back of her neck startled her into wakefulness. She was in complete darkness. Her wrists bound tightly behind her back. Her hands throbbed through the lack of blood, the fingers seemingly swelling under the pressure of the bindings till it felt as though they might explode. The smell was familiar, but she couldn't place it. The seat, probably of wood, was hard against her thighs and buttocks. She made as though to stand, then realized her legs were bound to those of the seat, She was incapable of any sort of movement. Sweat ran down her legs, her back, and into her eyes. Her throat constricted with fear as though locked in an iron garret, and she tried to scream, then realized she couldn't. She could barely breathe because her mouth was bound in tape. The man, if it was a man, stood over her. She could sense his gentle breath over the top of her head as he leaned down to her and spoke.